From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Straight-talking John McCain is a man of mystery. The avowed Republican is not afraid to continually attack President Bush's conservative agenda, sign on to Democrat initiatives, and bite the big business hand that feeds his party. This hour, the buzz in Washington, could John McCain be the Democrats' best hope for taking on the Bush Republican machine and taking back the White House? First, we begin tonight with political fireworks in France, where yesterday's presidential primary was nothing short of a shocker. Extreme right-wing candidate Jean-Marie Le Pen came in second and will face President Jacques Chirac in a runoff next month. Keith Richburg is Paris bureau chief for The Washington Post. Earlier, I asked how the French are processing the morning after election results.
It's fair to say that there's a real sense of shock and disbelief. I mean, the newspaper headlines say it all. One says the shock across the top. Another one says the earthquake. And a left-wing daily just has a picture of Jean-Marie Le Pen and the big words no across the top. So it's a real earthquake for a lot of people.
We've seen the simple numbers. I guess there were 16 candidates. Chirac, the incumbent, came in with 20% of the vote. Le Pen in number two with 16.9% in the early results. What does this mean about the state of mind of France?
It's interesting to look at those numbers. You know, among other things, you can see that Le Pen's vote from what he got last time in 1995 really only went up a couple of percentage points. He got 15% last time. This time he's going to get a little over 17%. But, you know, you have to add that to another extreme right candidate. He was actually a member of Le Pen's National Front and broke away, Bruno Maigret. He got another 2.5%. So add those together and you're talking about, you know, a fifth of the voters voted for extreme right wing candidates. On the other hand, you do have to look and see that the left this time was incredibly badly splintered. I mean, you had 16 candidates running, more on the left than on the right. You had three Trotskyite candidates, one communist, one green. You had the Lionel Jospin's own interior minister running against him. So poor Lionel Jospin can only manage about 16% of the vote. That's because the left vote was so badly split.
Still, it was a squeaker, and even the right vote was split, as you say. But on balance, is this being interpreted as a surge in extreme right-wing sentiment in France, or just a steady state of that right wing and the electoral logistics conspiring to give Le Pen the second place slot?
Yes, surge may be too strong a word. It was electoral arithmetic. He was running in a very crowded field, but also you have to say he was running in a year when a lot of issues played his way. He's always been a very tough law and order man, and this year crime has really been at the top of most people's agendas. Every opinion poll says the French are worried about crime. Secondly, the immigration issue, always a big National Front, Jean-Marie Le Pen issue. After the September 11th terrorist attacks in America, a lot of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden network cells traced here to France, a lot of concern about possible terrorist attacks here, and you have the huge North African Muslim population in France. All those things really played into Jean-Marie Le Pen this time around.
We've been hearing a lot, Keith, in recent weeks about racism and anti-Semitism in France. Are those real problems there, or are they seen as marginal? How are they perceived?
Well, they could have been seen as marginal, and the political leaders, of course, tried to portray those as just marginal incidents of delinquency up until now. Now you've got 20% of the people in an election voting for extreme right-wing candidates. You know, interestingly enough, among other things, these attacks on synagogues, Jewish cemeteries, this actually may have knocked up Jean-Marie Le Pen's score a little bit, too, because this is the kind of criminal delinquency and vandalism that he's been saying, elect me and I'll crack down on. So, you know, this general feeling of insecurity. You had a mass murder recently where someone in a little town called Nanterre walked in with a Glock pistol and assassinated eight councilmen. Those sorts of things never happened before in France, and people are feeling worried and afraid, and that played into what Jean-Marie Le Pen always does best.
Keith, we see today that Le Pen has come out blasting the European Union, saying he doesn't see its future as a foregone conclusion, that things are reversible, even raising the idea of France pulling out. Of course, it's just talk at this point. He doesn't have the power. But what does his second-place finish portend for France and for Europe?
Well, I was talking to a political scientist today who was telling me that, you know, France is going to be very difficult to govern over the next years. I mean, Chirac will most likely now win, and win by a very large margin with votes of the left and the right. But, you know, he's going to have to contend with the fact that a fifth of French voters voted for an anti-European, anti-immigrant candidate. France has always been a leader, really one of the architects of the European Union, and this, in a way, may be saying, let's go a little bit slower. There was no real vote here on a lot of the things like going into the euro and deeper integration into Europe, and a lot of people do have this feeling or sense of insecurity, this real sense that they're giving away some part of their sovereignty. Again, Jean-Marie Le Pen knows how to play into that when he says, I'm not left, I'm not right, I'm for the French. I am a French patriot. That's one of his favorite lines.
And what about the left, Keith Richburg? We've seen setbacks all around Europe, in Italy, Denmark, Portugal. What's going on with the left in Europe and France?
Well, you could see some more. There's an election coming up in about 3 weeks' time in Holland, and the Dutch government, which has been on the left for a while, could go to the right. So you've got Chancellor Schroeder in Germany facing a very tough challenge from the right coming up in September. It could just be that there's a bit of fatigue with the left. The left has been in power for most of the last decade in Europe, and this could be one of those natural pendulum swings towards the right. Also, some of the right's issues are playing now. This idea of privatization, liberalization, less taxes. People in Europe are pretty heavily taxed, and so the right is really playing on that. So right now you've got Berlusconi in Italy. You've got Aznar in Spain. You know, you've got right governments now saying, you know, let's go for more American-style management, let's go for lower taxes, and, you know, that could be playing out, too, to some people. And plus, as I said, on top of that, you've got the security issue and this sort of fear of insecurity, rising crime and immigration.
This story will be wrapped up quickly. The final vote is May 5th, I think. What do you expect to hear from Le Pen in the days ahead?
Le Pen's going to have a lot of fun, I think. I think he knows he's not going to win, but this is what he's always wanted, which is a platform. He's going to have a national platform. One of the big questions will be whether Chirac agrees to debate him. If they have a televised debate, Le Pen will have the biggest audience he's ever had in his life. He's got nothing to lose. He's always had a dislike for Chirac, and he's really going to come out swinging.
Keith Richburg is Paris bureau chief for The Washington Post. The Democratic Party is looking for a savior. President Bush's approval ratings remain in the stratospheric 80th percentile, and his conservative agenda is the American way these days. Democrats are worrying that none of their candidates have a chance of beating Bush in 2004, and some strategists, okay, just a few right now, but an intriguing few, are looking at John McCain as the new Democratic hope. He's independent-minded, an outspoken critic of Bush, anti-tax cuts set on regulating big business, and oh yeah, he's a Republican. But what if he weren't a Republican? How much does party affiliation really matter these days, the days of Jim Jeffords and Ross Perot and Ralph Nader? And what does it take these days to get to the highest seat in American government? Could a candidate for president stand alone, an individual almost beyond party definition? Do you find yourself liking John McCain, whatever his affiliation? Or do you still see a conservative just slightly off the reservation, Republican? This hour, Republicans, Democrats, John McCain, and the future of candidate-centered politics. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Jonathan Chait. He's a senior editor at the New Republic and author of the new article, What's in a Name? Why John McCain is the Democrats' Best Hope. Good evening and welcome, John McCain. Jonathan Chait, sorry.
No problem.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And from New Hampshire, our own news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jonathan Chait, you've been making mischief down there along with a few others in putting John McCain's name up in the Democratic column. What are you
up to?
Not
often confused.
Not often confused. But you say it's easy to forget these days that John McCain is not a Democrat. Why do you say that?
Because the revolt he started to wage against George W. Bush in the Republican primary in 2000 has continued and accelerated in the last year and a half in ways that people haven't necessarily noticed. It began as a small apostasy on a few things. On he was for regulating tobacco. He was for campaign finance reform. Then he came out against tax cuts, which is really a central domestic policy issue. Tax cuts is what defines all the federal government's priorities. But then it's continued into issue after issue. Several environmental bills, several health care bills, all kinds of regulatory questions. John McCain is effectively one of the more liberal Democrats in the Senate, even though he's a Republican.
And out of that, you are pulling this, on the face of it, kind of far-fetched notion, but maybe not, that John McCain could or should or might end up as the Democrats' candidate to challenge George Bush for the presidency in 2004. How do you see that transpiring?
Well, he would have to switch parties, obviously, and he'd have to do it sooner than, you know, right before the primaries began. It would help if there was some sort of draft McCain movement in the early primary states. But I think it's much more plausible than people make it out to be. I don't know whether or not it will happen, but I think it should happen because John McCain is a principled person, which I think most people recognize. He shares on domestic policy the values that most people in the Democratic Party hold. And he's a rare leader who can capture the imagination of the people and direct it towards the right sort of ends, not toward demagogic or racist or excessively nationalistic ends, but towards humane, rational, progressive reforms.
And he's got half a dozen lifetime, dyed-in-the-wool Democratic candidates already standing in front of him. Why shouldn't one of them be the Democrats' candidate to challenge George W. Bush?
There are lots of arguments. Probably the most effective is that he's the one who can most effectively win. I think it's going to be tremendously hard to beat Bush in 2004, much harder than it was in 2000. The main reason being that foreign policy is now central to the presidential elections in ways it hasn't been for the last three elections. The last three elections, we might remember, have all taken place after the Cold War has ended. During the Cold War, it was very hard for Democrats to win the presidency. In the last 20 years of the Cold War, the Democrats only won the presidency once and were quickly ejected because they had this hurdle to get over. Is he tough enough? Remember Michael Dukakis climbing into the tank, trying to show that he was tough, and of course failing. And if you couldn't clear that hurdle during the Cold War years, that was it. You were done. The voters wouldn't listen to what you had to say about domestic policy. Since the Cold War ended, it's changed. Even if voters don't think that you'd be particularly strong on foreign policy and defense, they're willing to vote for you anyway. But now, of course, since September 11th, we're back to a Cold War type situation. And this is what I think a lot of Democrats don't realize, is that you can't just try to neutralize the opposition on foreign policy. You've really got to convince them that you're extremely tough. It's a very, very hard hurdle to clear. And I don't know if any Democrat currently in the field can do it. Look at what happened in 2000. You had Al Gore, who volunteered to go to Vietnam, who was an experienced sitting vice president, who was a hawk in the Senate on defense in the 1980s, going against an inexperienced, lightweight governor who had pretty much dodged the draft by going to the National Guard. And people still gave Bush a huge advantage on defense. So I really think John McCain is uniquely positioned to overcome that hurdle for the Democrats with his remarkable prison of war story.
Jack Beatty, we're talking about John McCain, a Barry Goldwater Republican, Ronald Reagan Republican, and we're talking about him as a Democratic presidential candidate. We know it's just fantasy at this point, but what's gotten into the American political system that we can even be having this conversation?
Well, one thing that's gotten into it is that his base is riled up, and as the Bush campaign said, his base is the press. And reporters love this guy, and Jonathan makes an irresistible case for him, as do others. And you keep nodding your head, and you say, yeah, this makes sense. But for three points, to me, it doesn't make sense. One is John McCain's health. Apparently, the kind of melanoma he has is more virulent than we understand. He pretty much admitted that in an interview with Nick Lemon in The New Yorker, that this could come back, and he's had it several times, and that it's a very serious form of this. Now, that could cut both ways. It could essentially say, well, I don't want to run because I'll be too sick, or this is my only chance and I'd better run now. But the second reason is politics. There is a difference between party primary politics and general election candidacy. I think this guy is a great general election candidate, but the Democratic primary electorate is made up of, what, minorities, labor, women, and liberals.
Famously so.
Yeah, and I'll come back to my third reason.
We'll catch that third point. We're talking about John McCain and the maybe political fantasy football going around Washington that puts him forward as a potential Democratic candidate for the presidency in 2004. Can you see Republican John McCain as a Democratic candidate for president? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking tonight about John McCain and the hot chatter of the moment around Washington, that John McCain, a Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater Republican, could end up, should end up, might someday somehow end up the Democrats' presidential nominee candidate for the 2004 challenge to George W. Bush. What do you think? What does it mean that a Republican senator is making some Democrats salivate for him as a would-be candidate for president? What do party lines mean anymore? Is McCain onto something that both parties are missing? And what is it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Jonathan Chait. He's senior editor at The New Republic. And our own news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, you are giving two strikes against John McCain, his health, primary politics, very tough for any kind of former Republican to get past the liberal bloc at the front of that process in the Democratic Party. And point three, Jack?
Well, point three is self. This guy's whole career is built around the idea of serving goals higher than self, putting country before self. He was tortured for the country.
In Vietnam.
And he could have gone home, but he put loyalty to something bigger than himself above himself. Well, if he runs, if he switches parties, and he's got to ask himself in the dead of night, am I doing this for myself? You see, to get back at Bush. Bush ran a scurrilous campaign against him in South Carolina and elsewhere. He can't stand the guy. And, you know, I think in the absence of a compelling issue, and I don't see the issue here, I don't see how a guy like John McCain talks himself into it past that barrier of I've got to serve the country and not myself.
Jonathan Chait, how about it? Jack Beattie, number one, doesn't see an issue, and even if there were a reason, he says there's health, there's primary politics, and there's John McCain not wanting to jump into a grudge match, or perhaps perhaps wanting to, but judging that against his better interests.
Right. These are all problems of perception, not problems of reality.
Melanoma?
Let me start with melanoma. Again, neither of us really knows how his health is in whether that in any way would impede him from running, but we don't know that it would, so there's no reason to. We might as well proceed on the assumption that it wouldn't. And if it turns out that it does, then we can have that conversation when the time comes. Let me move on to the third point, then I'll get to the second point.
The grudge
running
match
for president is a selfless act. It's often perceived by people as a selfish one, and that's why candidates have to go through this fiction of pretending that they don't want to be president and that they're being dragged into it. But the truth is, if you think you have the right ideas for the country, then the best thing for you to do is to try to bring those ideas into fruition by running for president. There's nothing selfish about that at all. Now, some people think it is, but in reality, it's not. And so,
but we all know the human nature, and we know that John McCain was chagrined by the character of his contest with George Bush in South Carolina. We know that he's got a temper, and it's not at all hard to imagine that he might just want to come back and show this boy something.
That's sure, but I don't. That's probably true. I don't see why that's an important consideration. Why should we sit and worry about the internal motivations of candidates when we can judge for ourselves what the external results would be? Someone who donates money to charity is doing it so he can get on the front page of the paper and talked about cocktail parties. But
I'm talking about internal to John McCain. I'm not saying us. I'm saying that for him, this would be a heck of a barrier, especially in the absence of some issue. I mean, on issues, he's going to be a generic Democrat. What's the issue against Bush?
Jonathan,
in the general election, why would he win?
Well, I think he would win. How does he say to himself, you know, okay, I'm going to do this because I'm the only one who can what?
Beat Bush.
well, let's take
if you think Bush is taking the country in the wrong direction and you think you're the only one who can beat him, then the moral choice is to run against him.
Jonathan Chait, we've got a decorated war veteran, John Kerry, in the Democrat camp looking to run against Bush. The most recent vice presidential nominee, Joe Lieberman, a popular majority leader, Tom Daschle, charismatic Southern Senator, John Edwards, and then there's Al Gore. This doesn't sound on the face of it like an unqualified lineup.
I don't think it is, but again, I really think the foreign policy issue is going to be hard. Now, it's true John Kerry is a decorated war veteran, but he was also a critic of the Vietnam War. And remember, it's not always rational, but the way that people view Democrats is inherently suspicious on foreign policy. And I think the fact that Kerry was such a critic of the Vietnam War will hurt him just as much as his service helps him.
Jonathan Chait, Jack Bailey, stand by. I want to bring John Zogby into the conversation. He's president and CEO of Zogby International, an international pollster. Good evening and welcome, John Zogby.
Hi, how are you?
Great. You've done a lot of polling around lots of candidates, including John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
Do the numbers give any credence to this idea that's become the favorite of the moment of John McCain jumping into the presidential race as a Democrat? Do the numbers add up?
Oh, I think it's a real long shot. I mean, it's clear that John McCain's candidacy in 2000 was clearly one that transcended ideology and political party. That continues to today. I mean, his supporters are solid independents, and then they're independents as well in both the Republican Party and Democratic Party. So much so that people like the biography, they like the man, they project upon him the things that they stand for. So pro-life people who like John McCain and his biography believe that he's pro-life, just as pro-choice people can't possibly believe that John McCain would be pro-life. It's an interesting phenomenon, hero as presidential candidate. And for many, there is hope that John McCain will run. But as a Democrat, as I told Jonathan when we spoke, is the longest of long shots.
Well, talk to us about some of the combinations of challenger and incumbent here. What have you looked at? If John McCain jumped in as a Republican, if he jumped in as an independent, if by some miracle he did jump in as a Democrat, have you run any numbers? Have you done any polling?
Well, I only have run numbers of John McCain running as an independent. I haven't tried him as a Republican simply because, the first time around, he saw what happens when he challenged the party establishment. That's going to be a long shot, I think, especially now in 2004 with a pretty popular President Bush. On the Democratic side, a very crowded field, and while it's very possible for him to maybe even poll in the double digits, which is enough to beat a lot of the other candidates, I've got a poll coming out tomorrow showing new legs and new life for Al Gore. The Al Gore return is now bringing his numbers up, and it's probably going to make it difficult for anybody but Al Gore to win the nomination in 2004. So that leaves an independent candidacy. And there, I have said for a number of years now, there's a third party waiting in the wings to happen.
But it's never happened.
But it's never happened. The right conditions have to be calibrated at the right time. That hasn't happened. For a fleeting moment in the spring and early summer of 1992, looked like it could very well happen because of Ross Perot. But then by the same token, because he was Ross Perot, he had a built-in political self-destruct mechanism.
But John McCain's own hero, Teddy Roosevelt, tried it, couldn't make it happen then.
Right.
Is there any reason to think it could happen? Now, you say the moment is pregnant for that to happen. Why?
Well, no, I'm saying that there is a constituency out there waiting for something to happen, and to date, the moment has not been right. It could have happened in 1995 and 96, but a very bright Dick Morris and even brighter President Bill Clinton were able to triangulate and capture much of Perot's thunder and much of Perot's center. Mm-hmm. And so there's still the same people out there. They were the McCainites in 2000. Mm-hmm. But for now, the two parties seem to be too strong for an independent candidacy to happen. John McCain's power right now, and I think it's considerable power, is the hammer that he holds over the Republicans, and now it seems even over the Democrats, that he might be a presidential candidate. That now makes him larger than the United States Senate, and his someone with his own constituency and his own agenda that we see now he's been able to use pretty wisely to become not just simply a rabble rouser, but actually a legislator, somebody who can make things happen.
He's been making a lot of things happen, but we're talking about a big step from that. John Zogby, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
John Zogby is independent pollster, president and CEO of Zogby International. Michael's on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think it shows that the moment the Democratic Party bought in completely to, or nearly to Republican premises, the primacy of the market in all things, greater strength as being the only possible direction forward in foreign policy, that there really wasn't any way for there to be an effective Democratic Party.
And so we end up talking about a Republican as the Democrats' candidate.
Yeah, I mean, it may be that they're not entirely comfortable out-Herod-ing Herod, and so they're doing a bad job at it, or maybe it's just not in their nature and why people become Democratic politicians.
Mm-hmm. Michael, but, your line's a little rough, but we got your point. I want to put it to Jonathan Chait. What do you think, Jonathan? Is Michael onto something here? Have the lines, the defining lines between the parties come down to the point where this man can step to either side?
No, I don't think so. There are important philosophical differences between the two parties. The thing is that John McCain is an exception because he happens to be on the other side of the philosophical divide from his own party in nearly everything. He's, from what I understand, he's not even invited to Republican Party strategic meetings anymore. On pretty much every important vote that's taken place over the past year on domestic policy, he's been against the Republicans.
But he does have a history. He voted for Clarence Thomas. He voted for Robert Bork. He's
right.
He's been against abortion. Come out unfavorably with environmentalists. He voted for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in 95.
But he voted against it last week.
Mm-hmm.
He's had an important intellectual revolution, and to cite his old votes is not particularly relevant because the John McCain of 3 years ago even, let alone 10 years ago, is not the John McCain of today.
It is a pretty amazing lineup now. Here he was, shepherding the campaign finance reform bill with a lot of Democrats on board, of course, collaborated with John Edwards and Ted Kennedy on the Patient's Bill of Rights, with Charles Schumer on sale of generic prescription drugs, with Ernest Hollings on putting federal employees in charge of airport security over the White House's strenuous objections. I mean, time after time, he has been with the Democrats. Are they willing to see him as an ally, even as a leader? Can you imagine it?
I could see it. Look, there are a lot of issues where he's got more liberal guts than most of the Democrats in the Senate, or many anyway. He voted against the tax cut, which 12 Democrats in the Senate wouldn't do. He voted to raise fuel emission standards, which something like 19 or 20 Democrats in the Senate didn't have the guts to do. He stands up to the business lobby time after time. If you're interested in domestic reform, he's really the guy. And, of course, he can bring these independents along with him who are culturally alienated from the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So if the objection, which some people have, is he's not the liberal on social policy that they would ideally like, well, it's, perhaps they should consider whether it's worth sacrificing some ideological purity there to have a moderate, certainly not a conservative, but a moderate on social issues, to have someone who could be an effective liberal champion on domestic policy.
And you say a winner. Still, it's kind of mind-boggling. What do party lines mean anymore? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah, hi. I'm really excited about this prospect, actually. Let me describe who I am.
Okay.
I'm probably a Teddy Roosevelt liberal. That would make sense.
A century on. All right.
Yeah, I mean, because virtually everything you were just describing about McCain's views and votes correspond exactly with mine.
Does it bother you that he's a born in the bred in the bone Republican? Steve?
No, well, actually, I was a Republican and I switched because of Bush. I voted for Al Gore.
Oh, so you switched to vote for Al Gore, and now you're ready? Would you be ready for a McCain ticket?
Well, you see, I really wanted him to be on a ticket of some party, and I would have voted for McCain.
Why? What do you see in McCain?
Well, you know, basically, I was describing philosophically, or you know, the combination, which seems kind of odd in terms of the traditional Republican Democratic line, doesn't seem so odd when you look back in time to the era of Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back then, it would have made a lot of sense. I think now, the way things have evolved, it doesn't. But I'm fundamentally opposed to a lot of the things that have been Bush ticket items, like the tax cut. I think that was irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're mishandling the war on terrorism. We're doing far too much overseas and not enough at home.
So here's one voter ready to stand up for John McCain. Steve, thanks very much for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's turn now to Colin Van Ostern. He's communications director of the New Hampshire Democratic Party, and, of course, that would be the first line in the primaries. Good evening and welcome, Colin Van Ostern.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Colin, you've heard some of this conversation. You know the buzz that's been going around. Can you imagine this, from a New Hampshire perspective, ever transpiring?
Well, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
I read Jonathan's article, and the thing I liked about it best was the way that he analyzed John McCain's most recent philosophy or his most recent voting record, the work he's done on prescription drugs and on other issues. And he said how John McCain in many ways feels that his party, the Republican Party, has not been standing up to the special interests or the business community. I think what we're talking about is two separate things. One is John McCain becoming a Democrat. Another is John McCain running for president. Frankly, here in New Hampshire, we've seen a lot of Democrats, national Democratic leaders, who we're very excited about, who may be running for president in 2004. But that doesn't mean we wouldn't want John McCain in our party. Frankly, I'd welcome him with open arms.
Would he make a good Democrat?
Well, I think if he's realized, as many Americans have realized, that the Republican Party is increasingly being controlled by the special interests, and he's willing to keep standing up for some of those values he's been articulating recently as a Democrat, yeah, absolutely.
And do you think he'd have a chance in New Hampshire as a Democratic primary candidate?
Well, I really don't know. Like I said, I think there are many candidates, many national candidates who have been up here recently who New Hampshire Democrats are excited about. And I think being a Democrat, switching parties, as Jim Jeffers did, is a far cry from running for president.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things Jonathan talked about earlier in the show, for example, Democrats who did not vote against the tax cut, or Democrats who do not have a strong character on defense or a strong issue, being a veteran, things like that. I mean, most of the candidates who are running for president don't share those weaknesses. Most did stand up for our environment and stand up against the tax cut. Many do have very strong issues on the defense issue.
So you don't agree with Jonathan Chait's analysis that the Democrats don't yet have a contender who can defeat George W. Bush in 2004?
No, not at all. After September 11th, the president's popularity rating skyrocketed, and it's held high up there. It's starting to gradually come down. 2004 is a long way off. And frankly, in the short term, I'm not too worried. The other races that we've seen this past year, gubernatorial races, Bush's popularity hasn't carried over. It looks like it's not going to in 2002 either, in Senate races. 2004 is years away. If there's one thing we've learned over the last year in politics is that you never know what's going to happen next.
So you're poo-pooing the John McCain comes to the Democrats notion?
Well, no. I think it'd be great if he came to the Democrats. I just think that's a separate issue than whether or not he would run for president and what a presidential run would be like.
I mean, if
those are really values he holds, I think he should come over to the Democratic Party.
I guess the only reason he might is to run for president. Colin Van Ostern, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Colin Van Ostern is Communications Director of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. We're talking about John McCain, personality politics, and the possibility, still totally just a possibility, that he might jump one day to the Democratic Party to run for president in 2004. Can you see Republican John McCain as a Democratic candidate for president? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about John McCain and the flurry of interest in Washington, in the Washington press. Let's be right up front about that. In a Democratic John McCain candidacy for president in 2004, it sounds kind of absurd. On the other hand, maybe it helps us get an insight into what's going on with political parties and party politics in America today. What do you think? Can you see Republican John McCain as a Democratic candidate for president? And what do party lines mean anymore? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Jonathan Chait. He's senior editor at The New Republic. His article in this week's issue is What's in a Name? Why John McCain is the Democrats' Best Hope. Arch is on the line. Welcome, Arch. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Good evening.
I am a great admirer of John McCain, as I was a great admirer of Barry Goldwater. Not that I wanted to see either one of them be president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference of being an outstanding voice of one in 100 and being one of one. However, I wonder if you considered the fact that a great deal of this conversation about John McCain running as a Democrat is being planted by the Republicans and other conservatives as a way to embarrass John McCain and to embarrass the group of perfectly adequate Democratic candidates.
Well, we haven't looked at it exactly that way. I guess the place that this has been floated was in the New Republic, not typically that where Republicans plant ideas, and also in the Washington Monthly, again, not typically. But do you smell a kind of do you think that John McCain really needs any embarrassing by the Republicans, Arch? He's pretty well burned his bridges with most of them.
But that doesn't mean that they don't want to continue to embarrass him. I mean, you talk about his animosity towards W.
Two-way street.
You don't believe that W has equal or greater animosity towards John McCain?
Well, I guess he well could. Arch, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Jonathan Chait.
Yeah,
Jonathan, where do you see the source, the itch that's being scratched here? Where's it coming from?
It's coming from myself. the other article in the Washington Monthly was coming from the writer who had the idea himself. Look, Republicans fear the idea of John McCain running as a Democrat. The reaction I've heard from conservatives is, first of all, that they say Democrats wouldn't accept him, although Democrats I've talked to say, yes, we would accept him. Lots of them do. Second of all, I think a lot of Republicans realize that if McCain runs as an independent, it will probably reelect Bush. If he ran as a Democrat and won the nomination, he'd be a very likely shot to win it. I'd also like to point out that people should read my story for themselves. They can find the New Republic at newsstands or on the internet at thenewrepublic.com or tnr.com.
Jack Beatty, what about Arch's observation? You know that this hasn't this has come from the New Republic, not straight out of the Republican National Campaign Committee. But Arch says this is just embarrassing for McCain.
Well, I don't know about that. It may be, as you say, his bridges are already burned. I mean, the fact that it comes from the New Republic is telling us, to go back to my original point, that is John McCain's base, independent voters and the press.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with both parties is they each have a base. In the Democratic Party, the base of liberals, professional women, minorities, labor, they have a base that doesn't quite fit with the rest of the country, and the Republicans have their base, the Christian right, and so on, and the base can often put a veto on the kind of candidate who can succeed in November, and people are in that base for a reason, and you know the opening, it seems to me, in the Democratic field is from a liberal candidate who would be critical of the expansion of the war on terrorism, who might take a more independent line on the Middle East. And historically, that niche has not done well of the hawkish Democrat, Ed Muskie, Duke Jackson, Fritz Hollings, Al Gore, the deficit hawk, Paul Tsongas. These people didn't get by the Democratic primary electorate. Democrats are for that for a reason. They're critics of Bush's unilateralism. They're fearful of the hawkishness of this administration. So if there's any opening there, an issue opening, I would see it more on that side than on John McCain's hawkish side.
Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the idea of John McCain switching over to the Democratic Party. I find it kind of absurd. He disagrees with the Democratic Party on one major issue, which I think is a deciding issue for many candidates, and that is abortion. He is pro-life, whereas the Democratic Party has been and probably will be in the coming years pro-choice organization, and I think it's...
Well, I know he has been, but haven't the lines blurred a little bit on that, Jonathan Chait? Hang on, Eric.
Absolutely.
And how so? Where does John McCain stand on the
abortion
issue?
Well, no one really knows. A lot of people close to him think he's not pro-life at all. He said he wouldn't want to repeal Roe v. Wade in the short run or even the long run because it would lead to illegal abortions. He was asked what he would do if his daughter was pregnant and wanted to have an abortion. He said he'd leave the choice up to her, which would put you on the far left of the abortion spectrum because even a lot of pro-choice people don't think 15-year-olds should be able to choose abortion for themselves.
So he's moved toward the
fence,
you'd say.
I'm sorry?
He's moved toward the fence on that, then.
I think that's right. I think where he is probably like where Mario Cuomo was in 1984, which is personally opposed to abortion, although not in favor of it as a political issue. Clearly, he has little interest in the culture wars.
Mm-hmm.
So if Democrats could stand someone who's simply relatively agnostic on abortion but agrees with them strenuously on other issues, rather than making abortion the be-all, end-all of American politics, then they've got a good candidate in him. If you think abortion is the only issue in American politics, then he's not your man.
But it does sit out there. Eric, thanks for your call. Jonathan Chait, give us your bottom line then. Are there any signs or sounds from John McCain on this front? What's on his mind?
No, people in the Republican Party attack him for being a media hound and so on. And so he tries very hard not to feed into that. And so he and his staff don't discuss his presidential prospects. And so that leaves it up to people like me for speculation. Look, people have brought up time and again that the primary is controlled by liberals. The Republican primary also is controlled by conservatives. McCain came within a hair of winning the Republican primary, even though he was attacking values Republicans hold dear time after time. And there's a difference here in 2004. That is, in 2000, the entire Republican establishment was unified around one man, George W. Bush. So everyone who was opposed to this ideological challenge raised by McCain could unify around Bush. Whereas in 2004, there are lots of alternatives to McCain. So even if the entire party establishment decided that they would oppose McCain, which I don't think they should, and they may not do either, they wouldn't necessarily defeat him because he has such popularity among independents. And yes, also Democrats.
Jonathan Chait, we're just about out of time, but you've got us thinking, right. And it is a new world brewing out there. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jonathan Chait is senior editor at The New Republic. You can read his article, What's in a Name? Why John McCain is the Democrats' Best Hope, by visiting our website. The address is onpointradio.org. In a moment, George Bush.
I'm proud to be Texas, own a Texas ranch. And for us, every day's Earth Day.
George Bush and Al Gore are squaring off again, this time over Earth Day. This is On Point. A political rivalry was renewed on this 32nd annual Earth Day. In upstate New York, President Bush declared his commitment to the environment and pushed a plan to fight air pollution. Shortly after the president completed his speech, Al Gore made a speech of his own, declaring that the Bush administration is in the pocket of polluters. We're going to listen to excerpts of both speeches. First, President Bush in the Adirondacks.
Mine is a results-oriented administration. When we say we expect results, we mean it. We will set mandatory limits on air pollution with firm deadlines while giving companies the flexibility to find the best ways to meet the mandatory limits. Clear skies legislation, when passed by Congress, will significantly reduce smog and mercury emissions, as well as stop acid rain. It will put more money directly into programs to reduce pollution so as to meet firm national air quality goals, and put less money into the pockets of lawyers and regulators. My administration will foster technologies that I'm absolutely convinced will change America for the better. We will promote innovative ways to encourage conservation. I believe we'll be driving automobiles driven by fuel cells in a relatively short period of time, and we're promoting that technology. I know we need to promote renewable sources of energy to become less dependent on foreign sources of energy. Americans have reached a great consensus about the protection on the environment. We've come to understand the success of a generation is not defined by wealth alone. We want to be remembered for our material progress, no question about it, but we also want to be remembered for the respect we give to our natural world. This Earth Day finds us on the right path, gaining an appreciation for the world in our care.
President Bush, speaking earlier today in Wilmington, New York, timed as a rebuttal of sorts to the president's statement, Al Gore spoke 1/2 hour after the conclusion of the George Bush speech in his own Earth Day address in Nashville, Tennessee. Here's a brief excerpt of that speech.
All who care about the environment should speak out because our environment is under siege today. There's a movement afoot by polluters who have undue influence in this administration. In fact, they're pretty much in charge of the energy and environment policies of this administration. And they have a movement to dismantle America's capacity to limit their releases of dangerous waste products and poisonous emissions threatening to take us back to the days when America's rivers and lakes were dying, when the skylines were some days not visible because of the smog, and when toxic waste threatened so many communities around America. Our country is only as healthy as the air that our children breathe, the water they drink, and the earth that they will inherit. But instead of embracing the bipartisan national consensus to improve our environment, the Bush administration has chosen to serve the special interests instead of the public interest, and subsidize the obsolete, failed approaches of the past instead of choosing the exciting new solutions of the future. I read in this morning's newspapers where the White House attacked my proposals on CO2 and the statements I've made, and they said that the American people rejected my approach in the election of 2000. Now, I didn't bring up the election of 2000. I've put that behind me. They want to keep talking about it, so let me just say a word. He won the election, and he is our president. But he ought to be a little bit more careful about claiming that a majority of the voters endorsed his policy payoff to polluters who pressured him to break his promises to the public.
Al Gore speaking earlier today in Nashville, Tennessee. And Jack Beatty, you can hear he's still chomping for a fight there.
He sure is. Boy, those two speeches had ironies galore in them. There was an earthquake centered in the Adirondacks a few days ago. It's a wonder the gods of irony didn't create another one when President Bush was talking about renewable sources of energy, His energy plan includes multi-billion-dollar subsidies to coal, oil, gas, nuclear, oh, yeah, and a little something on the side for renewables.
Don't forget those fuel cells, Jack.
Oh, we don't want to forget about those. And, of course, he talked about the pollution from power plants. Well, of course, his own his EPA assistant director quit in a resignation in principle, Jim Schaefer, precisely over this, saying that the Bush policy would actually allow companies to pollute more those power plants.
But Jack, is there any area of policy that's more open to doublespeak and difficulty of public interpretation than the environment?
I don't know. I mean, especially at a time when the country seems, you know, when we're so vulnerable to Mideast oil and to a shock there. But, you know, Gore on his side in yesterday's Times, he criticized President Bush for ending a multi-billion-dollar subsidy to the auto industry to develop the supercar. Well, of course, for the Clinton administration, that was a way of not insisting on raising CAFE standards with the auto companies. It was a way of avoiding a confrontation with the auto companies. Instead, let's give them billions. Mm-hmm. Ralph Nader ran for president, partly because of that very decision, and President Bush did the right thing in canceling it.
Boy, I don't know about you, Jack, but just to hear Al Gore's voice and the hunger that's still there shocked me.
Yeah, he came back last weekend, and I think we're going to hear a lot from him.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Okay, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.